Welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And knowing the cult love and history around this movie, I'm sure at some point I'm going to say something offensive to a fan of this film. So let's just get this out right now. You can reach us at realgeekshfx@gmail.com or at realgeekshfx on Twitter. Because I'm sure at some point somebody's going to want to respond to something I say in this episode.
Oh my God. Well, in that case, okay. Damn. What lurks just beyond the trailer? this week, so we decided in a proactive move to get around our scheduling problem where we were bound and determined to miss thematic episodes at their appropriate time, such as, say, Halloween in October.
Yeah.
And we're jumping ahead of the schedule by a full year, a full year. We are getting a start on Halloween 2023. This month, it's 2023 Halloween in November, spectacular-itis, times 5,000, fireworks, it's to distract you so that you don't think about the concept. And we're starting it strong with some fantastic body horror and paranoia. This is 1982's The Thing.
Just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
You guys gotta listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
Also, I do want to be clear that when I say that I'm probably going to say something to annoy a fan of this movie, that does not necessarily mean that I did not like this movie.
Oh, thank God. For a minute there, I thought you were going to just be like, this is the biggest piece of shit ever. And I'd be like, oh, show's over. We're done. Canceled. Never again.
Oh no! That review will be for if we ever do Gem and the Holograms.
Okay, that's fair.
Cause okay, fuck yeah, that's fair. That movie so hard. And I'm a casual Gem fan at best. And still, fuck the live action movie.
It's cool. No worries. Just cash. Keeping it cash.
But John Carpenter is the thing that I actually saw for the first time in order to do this episode.
Really?
That's
fascinating. I had... Wow. Okay, because I saw this first time probably in junior high. It was always the minute you could find a way to rent it, you would. And if you had seen it beforehand, all the better. Hurrah. But It was one that I saw and loved, and then I saw it in high school a couple times and loved, and then I saw it in colleges a few times and I loved, and I've seen it a few times, and I watched it the other day again because I love this movie. I love it. I love it. So I'm really fascinated to hear what your take is as someone who was just like, this is the first time you've actually sat down and watched it, because while that isn't a rarity among like the general audiences, it is among, say, a sci-fi movie nerd. So,
fair, but in my case, the thing is, growing up, I was really not a horror person.
Mm.
I think I'd probably watched one Nightmare on Elm Street and one Friday the 13th when I was a kid. That just messed me up. I mean, I was like 8, but still. And so I've really only started getting into horror in probably the last 5 years, give or take.
Ah, I see.
So for me, with the thing, really the only true negative that I have with it is that it got John Carter'd.
That is very fair.
Yeah.
I can see that. See that happening. I don't have that particular perspective of it. I had never really considered that it could be considered like John Carter'd, and like, oh, it's clearly the origin of a bunch of stuff, but it's very quaint. It's so quaint. and so it's like, okay, that's different. To me, it is the early generation of Space the Imagination Station flavored cinema and sci-fi horror. So to me, it's not a horror film. It's sci-fi. It's a sci-fi horror, yes. But sci-fi is very, like, often very dark and meant to be very dark. And if you ever watched any of the original generation of Space the Imagination Station programming, it had a general darkness and nefarious feeling to it. Like, there was a dank. And I was actually just thinking the other day, while the culture of the dank is oppressive and backwards, the dank itself, I have mild nostalgia for. You know, like the dank in the back of a comic book store where you kind of feared to tread, and you might find really early 1980s indie comics that, like, the pages are sticky. Oh, no. You know, those don't exist anymore. And the culture that thrived in those kinds of places were bad. It was bad. But you could pull gems out of the dank. Like, every now and then you come out of a weird fucking cave system with, like, the one ring and the hatred of the owner who looks just like Gollum, you know? Comic book shop owners back when then weren't cool. They were slovenly.
Yeah, like, in my case, I think the only thing truly working against the movie is that I had already seen this basic story in other places.
Yeah. To be fair, so had technically Western audiences. This is, it's not exactly a remake, but it is a reboot, I suppose, of The Thing from Another World, which is a 1950s classic B-movie, black and white film that pretty closely follows this storyline. Like, you know, the characterizations are all different because, of course, like, the way people approached characters and heroic characters back in the 50s was vastly different from the 80s. And as well, the effects are vastly different. But, like, that movie was well regarded. It was up there with The Day the Earth Stood Still and, like, the original War of the Worlds color film as, like, classic sci-fi and body snatchers 1 through 5. Because there's always room for more body snatchers.
Oh, of course.
But, like, it was fully respected. And
yeah,
there wasn't really much interest in making this movie. Universal got the rights to it, which is funny. The Thing is a Universal monster. But even John Carpenter was like, why? The 1950s version was perfectly all right and good and serviceable, and it's fine. I don't want to do a remake of a 1950s sci-fi flick. And they said, okay, but what if you read the original novel Who Goes There by John W. Campbell Jr., aka the editor of, it was astounding, Astounding Science Fiction, aka later Analog Science Fiction, in fact, who is considered one of the granddaddies of sci-fi. Like, it wouldn't exist in the way we think of it, and the stories that are the basis of sci-fi and the writers would not be publicized and famous without him having published them. And along with publishing all of them, like Arthur C. Clarke and Philip K. Dick and, God damn it, I've forgotten his name. What's it? L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh, yeah. And Isaac Asimov. Why are we calling him a sci-fi author?
He was a sci-fi author before he was a religious founding lunatic. I have read the original, Battlefield Earth. I've read it. It is like 1,500 fucking pages long. And
why? Yeah.
Because it was there.
Well, it worked for Captain Kirk in Star Trek V, so I'll go with it.
Anyway... So the original is a fantastic novella from the 30s about, like, paranoia. Again, not much of it has changed. Focus on plot points and some action has been added, and the characters have been modernized. But from the original novella, Who Goes There, to Thing from Another World, to The Thing, it's pretty much the same story. And it's a beautiful testament to how you can take a basic sci-fi horror novella concept from the early 20th century and turn it into just this beautiful character study and thematic piece of horror. And then I look and wonder, why the fuck can't we get some good Lovecraft up in here? Which John Carpenter also will address, but that's for another movie that I adore oh so much.
fair. For me, one thing right away is, like I said, I'd seen this story in other places. Most notably, the series 4 of episode of Doctor Who, Midnight, which is basically the Doctor versus the Thing.
Yeah. But I'm pretty sure that was even in the synopsis BBC put out. The Doctor versus the Thing, comma, what do you want? God, you people are pushy.
Oh, yeah, like I can tell you, but with that episode, the thing that annoyed me is where they're trying to condense that story in about 45 minutes or so.
Mm.
The isolation and everybody in the essentially space tour bus going mad and instantly being willing to kill, that was too fast.
Yes, absolutely. It was too rushed, and it was handled by a writer who wasn't very good at that kind of thing. No offense, but just not your bag.
Like, between that and the 10th Doctor's series of specials, I would have taken Waters of Mars and Midnight and just flipped them.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Ooh, that would have been. Okay. Another concept. I'll have to think about that one later. Now, on the other hand, imagine if this was done in the classic Who, where it gets like 4 to 6 episodes. Just like a lovely slow burn with no budget. This could have been so good. Actually, I kind of want to do that. It would be easier to raise money and start it as a theatrical performance, as a like a touring performance. But The Thing, comma, with Doctor Who, period, yes, comma, in the same show. And it's just The Thing, but it begins with like the dog runs on stage and then the TARDIS appears and Doctor steps out of it and they start firing at the dog and start movie now. And so instead of like MacReady being the hero, it's MacReady becoming the companion.
Okay, I love it, but I do have one request. Seventh Doctor. Yeah.
Okay.
If this is going to be classic, I would go with seven.
I was picturing three, actually.
Okay, I could see that. My concern was more that I think most people would, when you talk classic, would automatically go to four.
Yeah.
Four already faced down Cthulhu.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Four is already too weird and such.
Yeah.
It would be too obvious to play into, like, well, aren't you a thing? I'm sort of like a thing. And it's like, no. You need the dignity, respect, and physical tenacity of like this absurd dandy man. Mixed with the fact that one, it's on Earth, so that makes sense for his character's history. Two, because he mostly dealt with Earth-based nonsense, like the idea of maybe joining up with the Thing and helping him build a ship and get the fuck off the planet could come up. And be like, come on, Doctor. They left you here. We can go. And meanwhile, it's just, yes, if I can replicate a Time Lord, I'm fucking in.
Oh, yeah, no, no.
This is starting to write itself, which is always a danger.
Yeah, like,
oh, no.
I went with seven more because I've been listening to a lot of Seven's Big Finish audios, and Seven got dark.
Yeah, Seven gets dark. Seven gets nasty.
like Seven easily got dark enough that this story would fit.
And like while the visuals would have to be pulled back, you can have the basic idea and the basic actions. And oh my god, what visuals. Sweet mercy. So as this is your first watching of this movie, do you know the history of how it done was made in terms of almost killing a man?
I don't know that. Like, I know things about how it tanked in the box office in large part because it came out, I think, a week or two after E.T.
Yes, it did. And like it offered a far darker version of like outer space life than anyone at the time was interested. And like this is between Alien films. This is after the first Alien, but before the second one. And so you're in this sweet spot where you can drop E.T. or if I recall, Mac and Me, and pull it off. Despite like it being surrounded by terror and fear, but unfortunately John Carpenter went just a little too hard on that at the worst moments. He didn't know that when they were in pre-production, and this movie was supposed to come out in the 70s originally, before he was even attached to it. So like Universal held on to this one and thought, like, any day now, and Star Wars happened, and they're like, any day now, and aliens happen, and finally people went, yeah, all right, let's do it. And so it's because of Alien that this film exists to begin with. And
I could see that.
Unfortunately, the producers bought more than they bargained for. In first of all, John Carpenter, who was fully committed to a recreation of the paranoia and terror of the original book, a writer who was fully committed to reimagining its own version, and holy shit, Rob Bottin hits Super Saiyan on like one of his first goes. This man was 21 years old and did the vast majority of the effects on this film himself by hand, which, and on a diet, ostensibly, if I recall, of Coca-Cola and candy, which led to him having...
Speaking as someone who has done that diet, yeah, that makes complete sense.
Yeah, and had to be hospitalized upon completion of the film.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, now that you say it, I do remember hearing that.
Let's see here. Just trying to find... for exhaustion, double pneumonia, not just pneumonia, double pneumonia, and a bleeding ulcer, all caused by working too much. And it paid off. I mean, even now, this film is gorgeous to look at. There are a lot of films from this era you watch where, like, the idea and the concept behind an effect is solid and sound, but the layering of effects and character shots and such just doesn't work quite well. And like, while it was ignorable on VHS or in the theaters with projectors at that time, now when you're watching it on HD, you're just like, that looks fucking terrible. Like, that looks like cardboard on a photograph. I'm embarrassed for you all, which is a shame because a lot of classic effects now kind of look like crap. And that includes like, fucking hell. I'm not gonna list off stuff. It'll be here all day. And no offense to the work there. It was state of the art at the time. But this all looks perfect still. beautiful.
I do feel like there's one exception to that. That opening shot of the alien craft coming down and landing looked like what I was watching was a remastered copy. And just with that one scene, I was kind of going... Maybe you should not have remastered that one moment.
I mean, isn't that kind of funny, though, that it actually achieves that kind of cartooniness that is meant to harken back to the 1950s version and
era
of that? There is one other actual moment, I will admit, where the effects of this do kind of fall through, but they do it in such a beautiful and fascinating way. So while the layering is not the problem in this shot, when the team initially comes up to the spacecraft crater and they're looking down into it, originally it looked great. I mean, it's obviously a matte shot. Nothing new or crazy about that. It's a good way to save a lot of money and have a beautiful looking shot. But in the past, the way, way back, you couldn't tell it was a matte shot. You had to, like, know it was a matte shot because screens were not as adept at showing you details. Now, with the screen that is like larger than I am tall and in HD, I can very clearly see the brush strokes. And it's like, oh no. It really looks like they're standing in front of a mural. And it's like, one effect in this movie. One effect failed. That's all right. The rest is still good. It's still good.
Oh yeah, like I said, that one opening shot did have me going, why did you do that? I wish you had not done that. And
it's a great way to lure people into a sense of like misdirection and complacency.
Well, okay, we're gonna stay on your point about luring people in, because after that, like I said, for me, this film was John Carter, so I couldn't get the isolation horror sense, because I already came in this movie knowing a fair bit about it. Like you know how we've talked about reviewing The Room at some point, and I've specifically said I wasn't interested in doing that because I already knew so much about it, knew all the key moments and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This it's basically what happened here.
And so that's very fair. Yeah, that can definitely ruin a film and completely throw out all of the ambience and feeling. Like, if, say, someone was first exposed to this via, like, Family Guy jokes, it's completely fucked. You know, like, you're never going to get the feeling that was intended.
I didn't get the isolation of horror, but the nice thing, it wasn't ruined. Well, I just ended up looking at it very differently, where I was looking at it more in terms of the mechanics of the film and the structure and so forth. And after that opening shot, the fact that when the screen titles come up and it's silence, and you slowly but surely can just barely hear the film score.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking, like, oh, you're drawing me in by making me look for what's supposed to be there but isn't. Yeah. That is really cool.
Yeah. And it's a brilliant like metaphor for the entire project. You know, that's what the thing is, you know, and that's what the thing represents. And it's just, oh, this is such a probably perfect film in the sense of like what John Carpenter is capable of achieving. Like,
yeah,
this is obviously the pinnacle of his work, and that's really saying something considering a lot of his other works. And like, he created the Halloween franchise, and there's the other two films in the unofficial trilogy of horror, like body and existential cosmic level horror, which is The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and At the Mouth of Madness, which is one of my absolute favorite horror films. Like, this is a man who bounces around from taste to taste of horror, and he just is an expert at every single aspect of it. Just don't watch Escape from L.A. Don't watch Escape from L.A.
Too late.
Oh, no. Oh, no. You saw Escape from L.A. before this? Oh, no.
Yes. I know. I'm going to make this even worse. I'm going to make this so much worse. I'm going to make this so much worse. I like Escape from L.A.
I mean, I can see how it's enjoyable. It's cheesy, cheesy fun. It's just... Yeah. It doesn't compare to Escape from New York.
Oh, yeah, Lord no, Lord no.
So good.
But yeah, even again, like before I even gotten through the opening titles for this movie, and I see John Carpenter and Ennio Morricone and Dean Cundey, And just from seeing these iconic names of film all in one movie, I'm getting more and more excited. And the movie hasn't even actually started yet.
Yeah, yeah. And Will from Brimley.
Okay. Like I said, I did not get the isolation horror. So for me, the single scariest image in this entire movie was a clean-shaven Wilford Brimley.
Yeah, no, it's off-putting. And
yeah, that is the most wrong-looking thing.
Right? Every time I start the film, I have this like picture in my head of Wilford Brimley in this movie, but he's older and mustached. And then you see him on screen and you're like, the fuck is wrong with this? Where is Wilford Brimley? Oh, right. That is him. I've seen this movie a dozen times and I keep wondering where the fuck Wilford Brimley is. Fantastic performance. He got it because the casting director thought he looked like an everyman. It's like, Wilford fucking Brimley?
You know what? In all honesty, I can see the logic. I really can.
I can see the logic. And it worked. So he was supposed to disappear from the audience's mind long enough for you to start wondering what's going on with his character just as the plot comes back around to him. And he's perfectly designed for it.
Yeah. And then once the movie the movie actually starts and it opens, we see the dog running across the plane. That was when the movie almost lost me again, because I was kind of sitting there going, okay, you're a group of scientists. You've seen this helicopter flying around essentially trying to bomb a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And not one of you really questions this. Nobody stops to like examine the dog, try and figure out why these scientists from this other research center are trying to kill this dog in the most extreme ways possible.
Listen, Antarctica will do things to your mind.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Like, I think this movie has the only scenario where you can really just brush past that.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Absolutely. Because, yeah, it's like this is such an extreme place that if you see someone doing that, you're too busy just trying to make sure they don't get you accidentally. Whatever fucking reason. Maybe they want to eat the dog. Maybe it's just that simple, you know, like who knows? You certainly don't think that it's an alien metamorphic parasite.
No, true. And I mean, like, I've often talked in the past about looking at a film from the story perspective and also from the more practical perspective. And looking at it from that practical perspective, I also know good and goddamn well that if one scientist asks even one question about the dog, this movie is about 20 minutes long.
Certainly. Yeah, it's true. I mean, they put it in with the other dogs, or they let it, like, before that, they let just wander the base. And it's like, maybe it's rabid. They don't fucking know.
Exactly.
It's just a dog. And it's a testament to a lax attitude of the boomers in their peak. You know, whatever, man. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever. But, like, God, there's some great performances in this. Everyone has an interesting character. Keith motherfucking David is a complete dickhead in this film, and it's just perfect because, he's a dickhead, but it's entirely understandable, not only in this situation, but, like, stuck here. Now, doing this. Fuck everything. And then you add on, oh, and everyone might be trying to eat you. Great. fuck everyone and fuck them all and fuck them to death. That's the Keith David way.
Oh, yeah. And like, on the one hand, you know, like you said, his character Childs is a dick for most of the movie, but they do at least have him see sense at the right time. And
oh yeah, he's not an idiot. He just doesn't trust the person who turned out to be the protagonist.
And like, also, to be perfectly frank, if you have an opportunity to see early 80s Keith motherfucking David, and you have to put the motherfucking in. I'm sorry, you have to.
Yep. That's law.
If you have that opportunity, you take the opportunity. Like, I don't make the rules. That's just how it works.
This is a pure strain of Keith motherfucking David. in his prime.
And being a fan of Big Trouble in Little China, Kurt Russell probably has one of my all-time favorite character introduction scenes here. Because it's like, we first meet MacReady playing chess with the computer, and in the back of my mind, Kurt Russell playing kind of a scientist, that's different. Where is this going? And then you see him open up the access port, pour in the ice, and I'm like, there's the Kurt Russell I know. There we go.
Yeah. Why am I playing chess? I fucking hate chess. It's a fantastic intro.
Then he accuses the computer of cheating.
Yeah, it's like, so good.
It's like, there's my Jack Burton. All right, we're good.
Yeah, it slides perfectly into a classic Kurt Russell performance, and it's a microcosm for how he eventually deals with the problem later. Douses it until it burns and shorts out and catches, and truly was going to be beaten by it otherwise. It probably was cheating. Yeah. Fuck it. It's terrific approach of like, saying right off the bat, this character will cut Gordian knots. He doesn't give a fuck about like whatever your seemingly logical next approach is for dealing with any problems. He's the kind of guy you want in a situation to just cut through the bullshit. And then they let him just kind of be a background character for the next 45 minutes. Which is really smart.
Yeah.
I mean, he's obviously like Kurt Russell, so it's harder to say not assume that he's, you know, the protagonist of this. It's one of those things of it's so obvious now because it's like, well, that's Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Fucking duh. And it was kind of obvious at the time because he was still the most famous person in this movie. Plus, he had worked previously with John Carpenter on Escape from New York. So, like, he was already doing protagonist roles for John Carpenter. But to the everyday person who didn't necessarily, like, follow his career or watch John Carpenter movies in the 70s, which is, like, a lot of people didn't at the time.
Yep.
Box office will show it. You may not know who the fuck he is. Yeah. And especially with the beard. Such a beard. Such a Yosemite Sam hat. I mean, it's Yosemite Sam in a horror movie. What does he do at the end? He blows it up. He's Yosemite Sam.
Yep. Yeah, he's like Jack Burton of the extreme, well, south, but...
So good. So yeah, everyone in this is great. Some great performances by performers I can't even think of the names of right now. The dog really nails being creepy as fuck at the beginning of this film. Something about that dog.
Yeah. Yeah. But as for the other performers, Richard Mazur as Clark. TK Carter was Knowles.
Yeah.
David Clennon as Palmer. Richard Dysart as Dr. Copper.
Yeah.
Charles Hallahan as Vance Norris.
Love it.
Peter Maloney as George Bennings. Donald Moffat as Gary.
Wow. Yeah.
Gary, you don't have to worry about because he basically goes on to own old Detroit and RoboCop.
What a team. What a cast.
Yeah.
Playbill. Really, like, a bunch of fantastic journeyman performers. Like,
yeah,
as you were
yeah.
saying with Donald Moffat, he appears in a bunch of stuff. And while his career never quite takes off the same way as, say, Kurt Russell, it ain't for lack of doing. That's for damn sure.
Oh no, the man had consistent work pretty much, I think. Yeah, he was doing at least guest work on TV pretty consistently until 2005. And then I would assume had a lovely 13 years of retirement until his passing in 2018.
Hey, why not? Enjoy it while you got it. But yeah, like, fantastic cast, great directing, really, really fantastic, like, suspense and paranoid-driven fear throughout the film. Incredible musical score by Ennio Morricone, because, of course, an incredible fucking composer.
Oh, yeah, like, just the fact that I'd swear he's using a lot of the score to simulate a heartbeat. And then that heartbeat gets faster and faster over the course of a particular segment.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely that yeah. like that slight building terror of, am I actually hearing this or is this my own heartbeat? Oh God, oh God! It's so wonderfully done. As we said, the effects that were Rob Bitton's magnum opus at the age of 21 that almost killed him. And of course, all of this coming together must have, you know, resulted in a financial and critical success. No.
No.
No. Because motherfuckers wanted their Reese's Pieces.
Yep.
Ugh. It took this film years. Years.
Yeah, this 100% went the cult classic route. Maybe. I mean, I know they couldn't have known this at the time, but maybe don't release your film a week or two after what would go on to be considered one of the greatest alien-centric sci-fi films of all time.
And, like, I can see not necessarily knowing that's coming up at a certain point, but you'd probably get a sense that, like, the Spielberg kids making a movie about aliens and it's going to be like cuddly and shit. Yeah, we should probably not put something opposite that is a horror, because yeah. when Americans look at where they're going to spend their money when they go to the movie theater, they're first of all, families are going to go to the family movie. They're not going to drag their kids to the horror. Second of all, people, once a film pops off, regardless of its intended audiences, people are going to go to that rather than go to a horror film. Everything about the release of it was good otherwise. You got pitted against a heavyweight.
Yeah.
And that heavyweight hit you and it didn't even notice you were there. Fuck it. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No. Like I think I said, this tanked.
Reviews of it initially called it like obscene, graphic, gaudy, and like over the top, just for the purpose of being over the top. Like, it's fascinating.
I can give you a few of those comments.
Oh, yes, please do.
So in one of the IMDb listings, it talks about how John Carpenter takes all of his cinematic failures personally. But this was the one that I guess had disappointed him the most. Some of the comments were Vincent Canby called it, quote, too phony looking to be disgusting. It qualifies only as instant junk. As someone who frankly thought some of the work on The Alien was some of the most creative designs I've seen in quite a while, I have questions.
I have no idea what that man is talking about.
Dave Kerr said it was, quote, hard to tell who's being attacked and hard to care. Roger Ebert was disappointed by the, quote, superficial characterizations and the implausible behavior. There were a couple of things where I could kind of, sort of, maybe almost see where he's coming from with that. But
if it wasn't based off a novella from Astonishing Tales and then a 1950s B movie. I mean, like, God damn it, Raj. Context, buddy.
I can almost see it, but I think with those comments, he's blowing it way out of proportion. And he apparently went on to dismiss the film as nothing more than an alien knockoff. Hey, Roger, welcome to the movie industry.
And, like, yeah, he should know better than to call it an alien knockoff. Yes, it was produced because Alien was a success, but it has it's a vastly different approach to, like, cosmic horror and paranoia driven horror and like insulation driven horror. These are two vastly different beasts, and one of them, you know for a fact, came first, and it's not Alien. I can see his points, but I also disagree with him. And one of the more annoying aspects of Roger was that he would, like, make short judgments on things, and then that's it. And it's like, but you're not even considering any of this, and he won't. And it's like, oh great, so, you know, a fucking genius of film theory and review who sometimes just did not give anything a chance.
From everything I've heard, more recently, he, I think, did very much have a tendency to be very just all over the place with his reviews. Those of you who have been with us for a fair while, if y'all think I'm bad, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
The
curve that he judged by was legendarily bent.
Yeah. But I'm going to give, in terms of the criticism, I'm going to give the final comment to Christian Nyby, the director of the original The Thing from Another World, who publicly denounced Carpenter's version, saying, quote, if you want blood, go to the slaughterhouse. All in all, it's a terrific commercial for J&B Scotch.
He's not wrong. imagine if they ran with that. And, you know, just out of focus in the background, you can see a bunch of stuff happening that you know is the thing doing grotesque shit. But it's focused on the Scotch whiskey. J&B,
yeah,
for when things go awry.
Yes,
I love it.
This movie actually would kill a multi-picture deal that Carpenter had with the studio. And Carpenter himself has noted that his career in his mind would have been far different if the film had been successful.
Oh, absolutely. Which, they were ready to turn him into like the next, well, I mean, James Cameron had just been like, it was at the very beginnings of being James Cameron at this point, but they would have turned him into another James Cameron. Like he would have gotten a shot at bigger and better. He probably would have gotten or been given like Alien 3 at some point, you know, stuff like that. He would have been given big budget nonsense and then been allowed to creatively do whatever he wanted at a larger scale. Instead, it took him years to build back up.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, and I may be mixing up Alien 3 with Alien Resurrection as I say this, but let's be honest, it probably would have been better if John Carpenter had done it.
That goes for both of those films, actually. For vastly different reasons. Yeah.
My point stands.
Oh, the Alien franchise. How I love you so close, and yet most of you is unwatchable. But if you did not enjoy this film like those critics did not, luckily there was a prequel film released in 2011. Mike, I assume you have not seen the prequel film to The Thing, also titled The Thing, because let's just be really fucking annoying about this. Presumably, you have not seen this.
I have not, but Dean Cundey's work in this movie actually made me want to watch that prequel.
Well, I have bad news for you. It's a pile of shit. Don't do it. Don't watch it. Don't do it. It follows the Norwegian team before this movie pretty much beat for beat is this film. Except the tacked on ending that connects it. And while they originally were going to do physical effects to match the physical effects of the original, they instead decide to cheap out and go digital. And guess what? It looks like shit now, and it looked like shit then. It is the most superfluous prequel in existence, and yeah, I'm looking at you, Phantom Menace.
Well, I think the only thing I can say in response is it does have Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And we all know I have a thing for Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Well, it's
so that
your funeral / 2 hours and change of your life.
But the way they set up and shot this scene at the Norwegian research lab, I kind of started thinking about the prequel, and I'm going, it's almost like Dean Cundey knew that there was going to be a prequel, and he shot that in a way that you see just enough, but there is so much that is left open that someone could come in later and build on it.
I mean, it's fantastic, like world building, that it creates a vacuum in the sense that it wants to be filled, and you want it to be filled with something. It's just, yes, there's something here. And it's just a shame that, like, the 2011 film would have been better if they had stuck to their guns and done the physical effects. The plot is very bare bones. It's just The Thing again with a different group of people. But the potential to do a kind of reboot prequel with some nice modern physical effects, that could have been just a fun showcase. It could have been fun in the same way as the various Texas Chainsaw reboots and such. You know, maybe keep the franchise alive a bit, but instead it was just embarrassing. Like, no, so bad. so bad.
Ooh.
So I think you might enjoy it for its pure cheese and shittiness.
Hey, fair enough, fair enough.
Speaking of cheese, this movie had various endings, including a few happy ones and a couple of overt dark ones. They shot a couple because they weren't sure how audiences would take it, and various writers had different opinions. One outright has MacReady getting a blood test and being confirmed to not be the thing, and it ends with him, like, smiling, and it cuts to, like maybe freeze frame, and some happy music swells, and then it cuts to credits. That was the super happy ending. Yeah, there's another one where they're both, like, MacReady and Childs are both the thing, and, like, they confirm it in conversation, and they sit in the cold for months until a rescue operation shows up, at which point they, like, both just get up like it's nothing and ask the rescue, like, the helicopter pilot, where's the nearest place I can get some hot grub, or some fucking bullshit exactly like that. And that's how the movie ends. Bup. Instead, we get the wonderful ending that Carpenter himself chose and stuck by while the studio was like, do something clear, which is just, you don't know how it ends. You don't know. Maybe one's the thing. Maybe both are the thing. Maybe they're both human. Doesn't matter. They're going to sit there until they die one way or another. That is the only thing you know. And everyone hated it, but it was the right choice. It was the right choice.
Yeah, like, both of the alternative endings you just listed, my immediate thought was no.
And that's, like, one of a few endings, you know.
Yeah.
Like, or two of a few, anyway. Like, people tried to fill this void so hard, and it didn't need it. Just allow it to drop off and be a mystery. I will say, there is one special tacked on ending that I wouldn't mind seeing. And it's where they're both sitting there, and, like, the fire is dying out, and they see a thing approach through the storm, and it slowly comes up on them, and it's a predator, and it's here to hunt the thing, and then it segues directly into the thing versus the predator versus alien versus Ash versus Freddy versus Jason. Full title. just hard turn, okay, right in the cheese.
I gotta be honest. On the one hand, that's literally insanely disrespectful to everything that has happened in the movie before that.
Yeah!
But at the same time, there's part of me that's just screaming those words that I have said on other episodes. I gotta know.
You gotta know. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the danger of an idea like that, because now it's in your head.
Like, as much as that ending for this movie is one of the most god-awful things I have ever heard, at the same time, that is a sequel that I would absolutely watch.
It would definitely, like, have it just cold start pick up with the two of them sitting in the snow. Have both the actors just come back. Don't do any, like, youth enhancing makeup or anything. Just both old as fuck sitting there, implying that maybe this fire has been going for decades, and they're just, like, glaring at each other. And then the predator walks up with
the apparent supply of kerosene that they had, that fire damn well could have been going for decades.
Right. Good lord. It probably melted through straight to the ground. It's just a pit.
To me, really, I think Carpenter was right. I think the only way that this movie could have been legitimately ended was with MacReady and Childs basically going, we have to sacrifice ourselves to make absolutely sure that not one cell of this thing gets off this base.
Yeah. And I also liked the minor detail that at some point the thing like gives up on trying to get out. It's like, fine, I'm just going to refreeze myself. And even then they're like that could be the end of the problem for humanity. Maybe we won't ever come across it again. It just wants to wait until something else comes along. It's tired of dealing with these people. God, they're a pain in the ass. And instead, yeah, MacReady's just like, no, motherfucker, you die. It's like, it's a fascinating drive at that point because, like, you could just walk away. The alien monster thing has decided, bygones be bygones. I'll go my way, you go yours. And it's the humans who are just like, nope. Fucking die.
Well, as I understand it from things I've heard about the movie, MacReady is a Vietnam vet with PTSD. He is not letting that go.
And you can like definitely tell that he is already quite shaken from something. And yeah, like Vietnam makes sense for the time period and the fact that he's like a helicopter pilot and his general clothing and such. But like, and his use of a flamethrower. But he's fantastic. Like the performance that you get from Kurt Russell when he comes back inside after being like let loose in the storm and left to freeze is so like sustained. Oh, yeah, that was wonderful. Anger. Like just I fucking hate you, I 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 hate you. It was incredible. He radiated pure hatred and cold. It was a brilliant performance.
Oh yeah, like if you told me that the only reason he did not die of hypothermia was like his anger and hatred was keeping him warm, I would 100% believe you.
Yeah, that would seem apt. Anger, hatred, and booze. So much booze. He's mostly booze. I'm amazed that they allowed him to fly, frankly. He's drunk as shit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, as we've established, much of the movie was a Scotch commercial.
Yep. And again, a damn fine one at that.
Exactly. Well, I think the only other thing I wanted to bring up was with Wilford Brimley's Dr. Blair, I kind of had an issue with some of his character in that. When I talked about in Midnight about how everything evolves too fast, mm-hmm. I did feel like he went from no idea what was going on to alien replicant out to kill us all. He got that knowledge maybe like a couple of scenes too fast.
I can see that. It would have been nice if there was one more bridging scene in which it's not explicit, but implied that he's about to be turned into the thing. You know, we didn't exactly get that moment. And so the mystery is sustained, but when he is revealed as the thing, it's like, okay, but when?
Yeah, like I would have liked if the moment when MacReady finds the actual alien spaceship, maybe that's the final piece that puts Dr. Blair on the right path to figuring out what's going on and realizing that this thing is replicating its prey on the cellular level.
Yeah, I could see switching that up and seeing if that works. It's that'd be a vast switch up. But yeah, it could work. I don't know, maybe there's a fan edit to be had there. Just retool the timing.
Like when you see him doing the autopsy on the body that they'd initially brought back, and like you see that okay, something is very, very wrong with this body.
Yeah.
And then you get the alien spaceship. And then you get the notes about the cellular replication.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you know, it's well worth considering because it wouldn't change much except just, like, help the logic of his character out about. Yeah, okay, I could see that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like, it's one of those, I was perfectly happy with what they did here. We got the slow burn that I prefer. Would have been nice if it was that little bit slower.
Yeah, perhaps just one but or two didn't more need instances. To be? Yeah. It works without, but it would be even better with, potentially. But yeah, like, I fucking love this film. I watch it every Halloween or October, along with a selection of other films, including At the Mouth of Madness and usually Prince of Darkness. But everyone says Prince of Darkness is the best, and I say, no, it's not, motherfuckers. It ain't got Sam O'Neill in it, so you're lying. Sam O'Neill? Sam Neill.
Yeah. Sam Neill.
It ain't got Sam Neill in it, so you're lying.
Yeah, that's another one that I haven't seen it, but from everything that I have heard about it, you are not wrong.
Oh, at some point we'll have to do both Mouth of Madness and Prince of Darkness to get the complete package. Because this is technically the start of an unofficial trilogy. So now that we've seen this, we have to do the other.
I'd be down for it. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, like I said, none of the horror aspects of this movie clicked for me.
Mm-hmm.
But how this is put together, the sci-fi aspects of it, I respect the fuck out of this movie. Like, Rob Bottin's work, especially in terms of the alien creature, like. You mentioned his essentially diet of Coke and candy, and I'm going, that makes so much sense because there are so many instances where you'd swear he's literally just going, okay, I'm gonna take a limb, I'm gonna put a limb here, I'm gonna put a limb here, fuck it, we'll stick a couple antenna over here, yeah, maybe we'll put some eyeballs on the end of those just for the hell of it.
There we go. And looks, it's like fucked up.
Yeah, it wasn't horrifying, but it's like. I'm looking at him going, I goddamn love the creativity involved in these designs.
Oh, yeah. And those are, like, unique and recognizable designs. There are action figures of those designs.
I gotta be honest, for something that was supposed to horrify people, I kind of want one of those action figures.
Ah, oh, I remember reading about those in Wizard magazine. Ah, what's a magazine? Ask your parents, kids.
Like, nothing. Well, okay, no, actually, no. There was one thing that did scare me, and I will give this movie credit for one of the most beautiful and legitimate uses of a jump scare.
Mm.
The second autopsy scene where Dr. Copper is autopsying, I can't remember for sure, but it might have been Clark. And all of a sudden his torso turns into a giant mouth that
no, that was bites Wilford Dr. Brimley, Copper's hands off. That was Wilford Brimley pretending to be to have had a heart attack, and he's receiving the shock thingers, you know, the shock paddles, and that's what happens.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of the classic effects, like, of this film. It's so brilliant. Just, it draws you in. You're pretty sure something sketchy is going on, but you're not expecting that because you've never seen that before. And suddenly his stomach opens into a mouth and eats the doctor's arms. Wow. And it's not just like chomp. No, it tears and pulls and wrenches flesh. Because Rob went hardcore and built like entire arms with like skin and bones and musculature and shit, so that when things were ripped apart, you could see stuff, and it was grotesque.
Oh yeah, no, like you said, Rob went absolutely all out with everything related to this alien. And sir, I would personally like to thank you for your work.
Yeah. And the doctor in that instance is an amputee wearing a cheap face mask of the doctor actor, which is why he just kind of like flails around screaming.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I also have to applaud the cinematography in that scene then, because I didn't catch that.
Yeah. No, it's so well done, and the idea is so well executed. This film is a classic for a reason. I'm still always a little upset that John Carpenter considers it to be a failure, because it's like, are you fucking kidding, man? Are you fucking kidding?
Failure or not, he apparently considered it one of his favorite movies.
Damn right it better be. Because like this is
like,
so there's a reason that we chose it for the first film in this series. It's a classic. Period. You know, like bar none.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Except no substitutes and except no bad prequels.
Okay. No, I was just gonna say that for whatever it's worth, like literally the very first entry I have on IMDb here is John Carpenter has stated that of all his films, this is his personal favorite.
Good. I'm happy, because I've heard previously that like he considers it, because he was looking at the box office and then what it did to him, a failure, like a monumental failure that almost destroyed his career. But it ain't. But unfortunately, we can't always watch The Thing and then tell you about watching The Thing. That, as much as I would enjoy it, you might find it boring eventually. So, next week, what are we watching?
Well, considering the four movies on the list and our now royally fucked up schedule.
Royally.
I honestly do feel like, in terms of the body horror films we've picked, I know what we needed to start with The Thing. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Of what's on the list, forget the one that I originally wanted to end with. There is only one on the list that I feel like at this point we can end with.
Hmm.
Which means there's also one that we need to get the hell out of the way.
All right.
So we're going to get The Human Centipede the hell out of the way.
Oh, shit. Oh, well, at least it's not The Human Centipede 3 or 2. This is a film. I have seen it before. I wish I didn't.
And on my end, this was one of those, why would I?
You have made a mistake in choosing this one. Oh, yes. I'm going to enjoy watching you suffer. Oh, yes.
I mean, I think we've already established I'm going to need therapy by the end of this set of films anyway. I mean, the fact that I think the only thing that's going to save my brain is the fact that we're now going to have to work Black Panther in here somewhere.
Oh dear. Oh no. Oh dear.
And all things considered, the fact that that is what is going to save me.
What a headspace to go watch that movie in. Oh no. So stay tuned pretty for that, dear listener. Oh, it's going to be fun and terrible and terrible and fun again.
So if you are feeling kind-hearted and would like to send notes of support in terms of what I am about to endure, once again, we can be reached at realgeekshfx@gmail.com or on Twitter at realgeekshfx. Or if you would like to send me sympathy directly, you can find me at The Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, or at themaritimelord at gmail.com or Crash.
And if Twitter is still a thing, you can find me at Friday in Halifax and everywhere else under at Crash and Burn. Until next time.
God help me.
Goodbye.